thank you very much for that. Here we have another superb panel covering more issues than we can get through in question time before morning tea, but we're going to have a damn good crack at it. Get texting, or as soon as I look like waving this thing around, get your hand up, because first in, best dressed. Can I start, though, with Richard Bergman, you were first. Let me start with you first. That question of cloud, and this follows through to a lot of the rest of the presentation. We hear that cloud is going to be bigger and better and all the rest of it. Doesn't that escalate the size of the risk exponentially? No?
Would you like more? No. I think from a cloud point of view, we did a real misservice to the world by having the term public cloud and private cloud, because everybody assumes public cloud somehow is less secure or bad in general. The thing about cloud, if you think about your current environment within which your information sits, it's a patchwork quilt of technology, of vulnerabilities, of holes, of investment that was made 15 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, and that's a hard environment to secure. And I'm having conversations with a lot of organisations around kind of flip the thinking on the head, find your most valuable data, your crown jewels, put that in the cloud first and secure it appropriately. And that, to me, is a huge benefit to an organisation, as opposed to everyone dipping their toe into cloud and saying, look, let's just move some of this stuff to cloud first, and that's safe, so it doesn't matter, and then we'll set up a private cloud for... You're just missing out on all the benefit of cloud. And we're at the moment working with Google quite closely and their cloud engineers around how we can actually change some security fundamentals in the cloud to make it a truckload more secure than anything that exists outside.
So the actress who took photos of her crown jewels and put them on the crowd, cloud. No, we'll leave that one and move right along, I think. Jeannie, cyber policies, where do you think they need to evolve to? I mean, you know, we've heard from the panel this brave new world, but the policies are there and are barely coping already. Where do you think they need to evolve to?
I think the issue here is... You know, in the U.S., we this all emanated out of the U.S., and then we have most of the claims statistics come out of the U.S. I think here in Australia, the focus has been, or the mindset has been, notification isn't necessary, so we're not going to buy the product. Notification may never be necessary here, but it is the right thing to do, and a policy... well-structured, and most of them, the wording's already in there, include voluntary notification. So I don't, from an where the product needs to go, it more experience on how to handle claims, and that will come, because we will eventually have the same large claims here that the U.S. has. But I think the mindset has to change in terms of buying the product. And it was a slow pickup in the U.S. when it was first unveiled. It's been slow here. It's picking up more this year than it did last year. And it's just, the big claims are just a matter of time. So, you know, once everybody gets sufficiently frightened as you are, then people will buy the insurance.
I'm moving to a cave with a shotgun and some tomatoes. I think that's the only solution. The kind of sound to hear, there is a question for Justine which actually flows on from that, that's been texted in. The privacy issues for organisations, can insurers use web-based information to assess risks within an organisation for pricing the insurance contract? What is the corporate and personal electronic footprint of the General Insurance Seminar 2014? Tell us about actuaries.
Sure. Look, of course, the vast majority of stuff that's on the web in terms of stuff that's not personal information, that's just sitting out there, flood data... Well, actually, you have to probably buy flood data, but you know, anything that's available on the web, you absolutely, it's not regulated by the Privacy Act so much in terms of any of that non-personal information stuff. If you're talking about personal information, then the fact that it's just sitting on the web and publicly available even doesn't mean that you can just go and collect it, because you need to hit the thresholds of is it necessary for my functions and activities. But generally, you know, it's a pretty flexible test, and you know, as long as you're, you know, meeting the other tenets of collecting it fair and not unlawfully, you know, you can if you set your goal as to how you want to assess risk, you can, and you can ultimately collect that kind of information. I mean, you're still within the same realms of, you know, discrimination acts, race, and all those sorts of things that you're prohibited from, and you can price your insurance contracts accordingly, unless you're, you know, discriminating on the grounds of race or something like that. In terms of the corporate and personal actual footprint of the general, I don't know what it would tell you about actuaries, to be quite honest. And it depends. I don't know how many of you guys are tweeting or doing all the things here. We might be able to get some very interesting information about actuaries and devise some interesting products for them.
It turns out the people who really know all about you is your telephone company, as we've heard. As we heard from Richard, I saw a presentation from a guy who's in charge of Singtel's R&D in Singapore, and he assured me that your telephone company knows if you're having an affair. It's all in the pattern, it's there, they know. And that's just one tiny example. Can I tap into what I think was a conflict in the presentations between Richard Enthoven and Justine, in that, Richard, you think, you know, as a businessman, that you know, consumers will benefit. It's all going to be for their good.
No, I didn't say all.
Well,
I said for the majority.
For the majority.
What will happen is the majority of consumers will benefit a reasonable amount, and a small segment will suffer disproportionately. So it's exactly like in almost any rating factor, the curve goes like that, as you all know. And so what we're trying to do with the data is to eliminate that tail. And, you know, in the case of flood, that just so happens to be people, it's pretty obvious, they live on a river in a floodplain. We can measure that. We know exactly where that is. And so, you know, when we went to address level pricing as an industry, those individuals saw dramatic and unsustainable spikes in the cost of insuring those properties. But those prices are realistic. That is the risk. That is the market sending a signal about risk. So when we can use other data to eliminate that curve, and that data might be, you know, how often you phone Russia or how often you phone the United States, or it'll be down to you guys to devise and come up with the recommendations and the insights. The exercise of that will primarily, in my view, be to find the tail, eliminate the tail, and then give everyone else a discount.
Well, can I try to tap into a bit of conflict? Because everyone loves a fight. That's what I'm after here. You think we will eventually be able to use social media to write business, but Justine, you're saying no. Or what's, to use the Castle's term, what do you think the vibe is versus what Richard would like to do?
Look, I mean, my personal perspective is that, you know, a lot of people in terms of, say, social media have a number of different profiles, a number of avatars. They say false things on the internet. They talk it up. The quality of data, as Paul is saying, is pretty average. And I have to be honest, in terms of an organisation that's maybe riding risk, some of that kind of stuff is, in my personal view, a bit useless. And also, too, it exposes itself to a real quality issue. And, I caution against the use and of that kind of information. You can use it, but you certainly can't collect it from a Privacy Act perspective if you're collecting it deceptively. So, you know, you can't pretend to be, unless, of course, you're investigating fraud and, you know, there's a whole range of exceptions to the Privacy Act, but you can't just go out and just scour the internet and public information and just collect it without having necessary functions and activities.
But, Richard, you want to do that, don't you?
Mm. Well,
he does.
I spend a lot of my waking time thinking about how I can give a better deal to a subset of the market and therefore poach 0.1% market share. And whether that's using social media or telephone company data or bank data or parking meter data, I don't know what the solution is. I don't have it, otherwise I'd already be doing it. But 7 or 8 years ago, we introduced discounts for low kilometers, and that created a pocket of people that we were able to provide a much better product for. And, you know, that is now kind of that rating factor has now been kind of broadly adopted by the industry. And there will be other companies adopting new things. And I didn't say it specifically had to be social media, but it does feel like a rich ground of information that somebody will be able to make sense of. But I certainly don't have the answer.
So if I could just... So we currently scrape, collect all of the social media data in the world that we can. Right, so we do that quite proactively, and we do it for a number of reasons, and many companies do, mostly for marketing purposes, a bit different for us. We're actively using social media at the moment for threat intelligence around cyber, because the bad guys organise themselves like we organise ourselves, and they use social media to correspond and connect, some of it not necessarily the mainstream social media, some of it maybe on the dark side of the internet, but we're actively collecting, scouring, all that sort of stuff, and I use it every day. For the purpose of forensic investigations as well, right? Because we want to know what people are actually saying, doing, located, etc. So I think that stuff's happening. I'm not just... I don't think people have taken the leap to say, well, now we can use that to customise, tailor and price insurance, which to me makes sense, because if you filled out your insurance form and you haven't told me that you ride a very fast motorbike and you like bungee jumping on the weekends, that's sort of information I'd like to know.
Don't you just love this language? The dark side of the internet. This is where the bad guys hang out. And this all leads to a question to Paul, which is, Richard wants to go and get all this other crappy data and feed it all in on top of the analysts. Isn't artificial intelligence meant to ride to the rescue? Aren't they meant to be super smart, crawling robot computer analyst type things that's going to go through the rubbish dump and do all the hard work? Or is that science fiction?
Well, one thing you learn is science fiction pretty soon becomes science fact. And yes, with the use of artificial intelligence and also machine learning, it can definitely process a lot of the basic data that is there. The big thing with any data investigation, one, you got to sort of know what you're sort of looking for, and two, you got to understand the rules. You know, what is it and what context is it in? Automation will help us, but still, you know, until Watson really comes into full swing, you know, it's debatable about the outcomes, because decisions through machine learning have the premise that the data is correct. If you feed it incorrect data, it gives you the right answer with the wrong data. And that is part of the problems. I think more and more companies are taking it on. More and more companies are really gaining the insight now through the unstructured data. You know, doing things like actually having Hadoop clusters, Hadoop 2, you know, with a layer for those techies in the group with Storm, and really investigating those areas and then adding machine learning and even, you know, some of the models that we build, you know, the basic SPSS type models with learning capabilities. You add machine learning into that, it can do a lot of the heavy lifting. But the trouble is that unless you're watching the data, it could be telling you stuff that actually is not correct. So it's pretty immature at the moment.
I actually Googled Hadoop when you said, if you don't know what Hadoop is, and I Googled it and I still don't understand what it is, which is why I'm going to the floor for your questions, and we haven't got much time, so jump in and be quick. Don't wait for someone else. Thank you very much.
Hi, Amanda Aitken at Actuarial Edge. Richard B., you started off talking about data that's available for purchase at the moment, and Richard E., you talked about all the data that's collected from individuals, primarily by telcos and other companies. Can you see, I'm interested in anyone on the panellist's view, can you see a future where there's a marketplace for individuals to effectively sell their data or be remunerated in some form, whether it's through dollars or some other currency?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fascinating question, and I about a year ago I saw a guru in this space, an American guy with dreadlocks, speaking, I think, in this room, and he said that's exactly where it's going to head. He said that, you know, as he looks to the future, he thinks that individuals are going to take ownership of their data and effectively going to charge for putting it in the public domain. I mean, obviously, how that happens, that's a complicated problem to solve, but that data is worth a lot to people like me. And, you know, if I could buy it and use it legally and it was accurate, I would do that. So it feels like a classic market opportunity.
Absolutely.
And I suspect it's one of the things that somebody in Silicon Valley is working on right now.
There's sort of a segue there to a question that's come from text. Does the value of data create a barrier for new entrants and support the protection of the existing duopoly in insurance? Does the data that the big guys already have...
Yeah, I mean, I think you have different sides of the equation are going to argue different points here. My sense is it does exactly the opposite. So if the only data we had was our own traditional data and there was no access to external big data, then having the biggest private data source would be a huge competitive advantage. But increasingly people are using other data, and that, you know, the large companies don't have a monopoly over that other data. And in fact, you know, what's to stop Telstra not opening their own insurance business and using their data? So it actually, in my view, creates more space for potential new entrants to play the game in a different way.
You don't think Telstra's got enough trouble? No, we won't go there either. Over to you, because some of you people probably know what a Hadoop is if you saw one running down the street. Or whatever they do. Maybe they crawl down the street. No? Don't all ask questions at once? Ah! Thank you. While I'm on the way over, though, let me read to you. Is the coming battle with UFIs in FNQ a dry run for the regulated establishment's turf war with peer-to-peer and other non-traditional insurance? Who wants to tackle UFIs in FNQ? Now, I know what FNQ means. Nothing to do with Hadoops. Is that an opportunity? If the UFIs are let into FNQ, is that an opportunity for another use of data altogether? That sounds like an insurance council sort of a question, Richard.
Yeah, and I'm going to give you the insurance council answer. in my view, this is a solution to a problem, which is a real problem, which is not going to solve the problem.
How would you rate that data there, Paul? That was a good use of data in the answer?
Yeah. It just shows that you just don't know what you don't know, I think, is the first thing. Look, as more and more data progresses, and as we measure more and more and we collect more and more, there's going to be just different data sets that give us the insights we need. And that's the trick of you guys, is to find them, right? Because competitive advantage in data will only be when you can find that data set that makes you unique. And the fact is, I think as was discussed, big companies don't have the leverage anymore. Because the velocity is important and because it's changing at such a rate, you know, you need data that is current and moving quickly and understand that. So I think the trick is, yeah, you can take traditional views, but maybe the answer is in something that you haven't found yet, and that's your job.
I would say as a consumer, as opposed to a panelist, the concept of crowdsourced self-insurance appeals to me.
Yeah.
So if I can find like-minded individuals with a similar risk profile to myself, and we can crowdsource our own self-insurance, that to me means that I can actually not have to pay a premium every year, but actually get some of that money back when our crowdsourced funding has hit an appropriate level. And I would insure myself for certain levels of my own choosing, so I can have a lot more say in the risk and the premium associated. That's a simple thing to get set up and running on the internet nowadays.
Yeah, and loads of people are working on it.
Jenny, does that scare Marsh?
No, I'm sure we'll just jump in that space. It's probably the wave of the future. I mean, we tend to, the segment I work in, we deal with large corporations. That sounds like something more individual-wise, but it changes every day.
From the floor.
Jeff Thorpe from Westpac General Insurance. Richard Enthaven, you mentioned that people could tailor their products, or you could tailor products for people based on their information. I can see a couple of risks in that. One, that the information that you produce might give you the wrong cover that they need. They might not understand their cover, which I think, given that we've had talks yesterday about having to provide products which are fit for purpose because people don't understand it, do you see a risk in that? Do you see something that overcomes that side of things?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question. There's risks in every change has risks. And, you know, some change, the risks are going to, with the benefit of hindsight, have outweighed the benefit, and in another case, they won't. For me, as a CEO, the biggest risk is standing still. So I am hardwired to take risk for opportunity and manage risk for downside. But given I've got 1% market share, I don't think standing still is an acceptable proposition. So yes, there's risks, and I think as an industry we have to work a lot harder on improving the understanding of what we're actually selling. But I think consumers also have to take some responsibility that it's not unreasonable to expect consumers to at least read their certificate of insurance, if not their, you know, product disclosure statement. So I think it's a great question, and I think it's like all key corporate decisions, it's around, you know, making a risk-adjusted return and taking decisions in a risk framework. And depending on where you sit, you know, your downside risk is going to play a bigger role in the equation, I think.
And the final question from the floor, right at the back of the room.
Hello. Can I get your thoughts on the reputational risk in collecting the data, particularly in relation to a scandal in February this year in the UK? I'll just read you a paragraph of what appeared on the front pages of most of the major newspapers. It has emerged that a major insurance body bought more than a decade's worth of hospital data covering 47 million patients, which it was claimed is to be used to help insurers refine their premiums. The Staple Inn Actuarial Society said that the data covering all hospital inpatient stays between 1997 and 2010 was used to track patients' medical histories identified by date of birth and postcode, according to the Daily Telegraph. The details were then reportedly combined with information from credit rating agencies and used to advise insurance companies, resulting in increased premiums for most customers below the age of 50. Now, that particular story was big news in the UK at the time, and there's a very interesting rebuttal that came out from the Staple and Actuarial Society about what really happened. But what people are left with is the impression of what I've just read, which is not an accurate description of what they really did, but is a very accurate description of what the general public heard and saw about the situation.
That could go to just about every member of the panel. Very, very quickly, as we're on time, Justine, just legally, would that...
Sure. I mean, it's that overarching thing as to why they collected that sort of information in the first place and whether or not they actually needed it. And clearly, you know, the reputational risk is one thing, but in Australia with the new Privacy Act bringing in penalties for serious breaches, you'd arguably say that, that's a serious breach where you're actually getting in a hold of information that you're not necessarily going to use it for the purpose you collected.
And they could be fined? Not much.
It's quite a lot, but I have
a lot for you, a lot for me.
1.3 million per instance. It's sort of a bit of a sliding scale.
Well, but then in terms of what happened, can I broaden that a little bit to say, wouldn't it be a good idea if they could? No one's jumping on that one, are they?
I think on the privacy side. I think, yeah, if it's NHS that's actually sold the data, the obligation may actually, from a privacy point of view, I mean, it does sit with both, but if they were allowed to collect it and sell it and had consent from every patient, then that's okay. I think the public would react differently if it meant all of their insurance premiums actually went down below 50 years of age as opposed to up. And
It's actually in some ways more about the reputational risk. Obviously. Because what I read to you was what people understood to have happened from the newspapers. That isn't what actually happened. It was really a research piece of work done by somebody at the Stapel and Actuarial Society for a paper they were presenting. It wasn't funded by the insurance companies. It wasn't the way it was presented, but there was huge reputational damage done to the Actuarial Society, but also the insurance companies in terms of the way people saw their use of data.
So reputational risk at the moment is of a high concern to a lot of organisations, but not because of the impact on their reputation, but on the willingness and likelihood of a customer to choose and change quickly. And we're in an era now where most consumers, and there's a lot of research around it, will actually choose brands, change loyalty, essentially at the drop of a hat. So there's a significant cyber breach. Most people are happy to change brands rather quickly, similar for that sort of reputational risk side of things. So the knock-on impact to an organisation is significant. When Qantas had the A380 incident coming out of Singapore a few years ago, there were about 4 hours of social media mayhem that went on around the world before Qantas was actually able to tweet an official tweet that says, actually, our plane's okay. And they learned the hard way how quickly reputation can be stolen off an organisation, even though it's based on incorrect fact. And I'm a big believer that if you look at food safety recalls, those that have been done really, really well enhance a brand's reputation. Mm. Those that are done badly ruin a company's reputation, yet the same trigger or cause happened in both instances. So how you react and respond is probably either to your benefit or make it worse.
Unfortunately, we are not just out of time, we're over time. I'd blame the MC and sack him for this, but he was working with analysts, so they forgive everything. We are over time because there's further to go on that question. There is a question of also, I suspect, about whether the Insurance Council needs to be more proactive in fighting some of the pseudo-privacy that's around. What employer doesn't have a look on Facebook to check out the potential person they're going to hire? But we won't go there either because there's a lawyer in the room. Instead, what I would ask you to do is to thank our fantastic panel, the Richard, the Justine, the Jenny and the Paul.